Now, Nick Hornby is the best-selling author of novels such as High Fidelity, not the book I mentioned before the break, High Fidelity and About a Boy, along with several works of non-fiction, including his groundbreaking debut, Fever Pitch. He has written numerous award-winning screenplays for film and television, including Brooklyn, Wild and State of the Union. Just Like You is his ninth novel. It tells the story of Joseph, a 22-year-old working-class black man, and Lucy, a 42-year-old white middle-class teacher, who fall in love against the backdrop of North London on the brink of the Brexit referendum. And delighted to have Nick Hornby join me on the line now. You couldn't have put more obstacles between your two characters here, really, Nick, could you? Joseph, the 22-year-old working class black man, Lucy, plus 20 years, a 42-year-old white middle class teacher. Chalk and cheese, really.
Well, as it turns out, I think the book demonstrates that they're not, but the obstacles that were in their path looked as though they'd be enough to deter them or anyone else, actually.
Was there one or other of those obstacles that, you know, even at the starting point, you thought was going to be the one that would be the biggest problem for them to overcome?
No, I didn't think so, but as I wrote the book, I could see that age is actually the hardest one to think about and to address if you're in a relationship. There's 20 years between them, and age is so defining in so many ways. So they kind of have to come to an agreement to stop time temporarily and see where that takes them.
Yeah, in particular, that isn't helped by the fact that that Joseph has a penchant, even though he works in a butcher shop, he has a penchant for DJing. And the music that he might be DJing to or making as a DJ, Lucy is a long way away from that music.
Yeah, there's a rather crushing moment for her when she tries to express enthusiasm for something that he's made by dancing a bit. And clearly it's the most excruciating thing I've ever seen, and he has to interrupt and stop it.
Yeah, I didn't know that a 42-year-old white middle-class woman could do dad dancing, but it kind of sounds as if that's kind of what she was doing.
Well, it wasn't his sort of dancing anyway, so
That's for absolute sure. So when you started out then, Nick, were you still thinking, were you working towards a romance, really, and simply how did these two people overcome their difficulties, or in fact find out that the difficulties aren't as big as they think they are? Was it just a romantic story that you were exploring, or when did the politics start to click in?
Well, I had the idea of the couple some time ago. I'd observed a couple in a shop having a little flirt, and I just, as I was watching, thinking, oh, they'll never get together. This was a customer and someone behind the counter, even though they were quite cute. And I could see why they wouldn't get together, because there were differences between them. And as I came away, I thought, actually, I wonder if those differences are as important or as profound as we really think. And I kept thinking about it every few months, every year or so. And it wasn't until the referendum and the aftermath that I thought, oh, actually, maybe now is the time to write about what separates us.
Yeah, because what's very interesting, I mean, you said to me at the very top of this that, in fact, you know, they aren't chalk and cheese, despite the fact that they seem to have so many differences between them. They are eminently suited to each other. Was, you know, what was happening in Britain, particularly around the time of the referendum debates, it was all about how different we all are, I suppose, how different those who want to stay are from how different those who want to leave are, or where.
Yeah. And I started to get irritated with my own team, actually. I voted Remain, and I didn't talk to that many people before the referendum who were voting to leave. But afterwards, I started to observe really how far out of our comfort zone we'd all been taken, and we were having passionate arguments about things we knew nothing about. I mean, I know my friends know everything about movies and books and Arsenal and so on, but they were shouting at each other about World Trade Organization terms. And I thought, how has this happened that we're pretending this knowledge?
So, and it was irritating to you, even though you were on the same side as many of these arguments.
Well, it a lot of the time it ended up being insulting to the other side, and I thought, actually, this really isn't good enough because it's half the country, and you can't call half the country misguided or stooges or dim. There's something more than that going on. So when I was writing the book, I wanted to adopt a neutral position, and in fact, Joseph in the book ends up spoiling his ballot paper and voting for both sides because he's torn between some of the people he knows from home and Lucy, who's an ardent European.
And what about then, you know, the issue of, as you were quite definitely a Remainer or a voter for Remain, how difficult was it for you to, because you do go into trying to find characters and exploring characters then who would have been leavers, who would have voted leave. Was that a difficult aspect of the writing?
No, I kind of relished it because I wanted to think about it more and I wanted to listen to people. You know, I was online a lot and reading things and thinking how have they arrived at the position they're at. And it felt quite refreshing, actually, to present the other side sometimes.
And did you wonder, did the writing of the novel perhaps bring you to a greater understanding of the other side of the argument?
Yes, completely. And I don't know how many people would change their minds if they could see the mess that has been made and is about to be made. But at the time, I can see what was going on.
You said you were irritated by those who were on the same side as you. Were you less irritated by those who weren't on the same side, or were you more irritated?
In my book, I was less irritated because I made characters that I like. I got fed up with watching people on Question Time and the like just chuntering on about out means out. I mean, that was the other thing, is that words lost all their meaning. And no argument took you anywhere. But the day after the referendum, I was sent, as were a lot of people, a petition. And the petition was to either overturn the vote or to have another vote. And I, at the time, I thought, this is crazy, you know? 17 million or 18 million people have just voted to leave, and 500,000 people are saying you've got to ignore the result. And it was so profoundly undemocratic that I began to be a bit troubled by it.
So your democratic bones kicked in immediately saying, yeah, I voted my way, more people voted the other way, so let's just get on with it.
Yeah, and let's see who's right, actually, in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can probably guess who you think will win that particular debate. So obviously, you know, get two sides of the argument in a work of fiction. You give us there the pro-Brexit and the anti-Brexit, if you like. Your two leading characters here, Lucy and Joseph, I suppose both of them you had to make quite big leaps of the imagination. You know, you have to put yourself into the shoes of a 22-year-old young black working class man and into the mind of a 42-year-old middle class North London based teacher. Was either or one of those more difficult than the other?
No, I mean, I think the moment you start writing about people who are not yourself, which I did, you know, not in my career, but at a certain point, then everything has to be imagined and you have to feel around to see if it seems true to you. With Joseph, I was more nervous because of, you know, the way the world is at the moment, and I didn't know if I had the right to do it, but I eventually decided that I have to write about everyone in my community, not just people who are the same colour as me.
And how did you? I mean, you had reservations. What kind of reservations did you have, and how did you face those down? As you probably had to do in some ways within yourself. I mean, face them down.
Well, the thing about being a writer is you can be an idiot up until a certain point because it's just you and the computer. I remember feeling that when I wrote Fever Pitch. You know, I was writing a memoir about me and my family, and I thought, oh, this is fine, you know. And then you see it in a bookshop, you think, oh, my God, what have I done? So to a certain extent, I was just trotting along quite happily and creating a character you know, drawn from people I knew and things I'd seen. But when I'd finished, then I showed it to people of colour and said, right, you can beat me up about it now. You know, there were a couple of suggestions which I acted upon, but mostly I just had to trust myself. And if the book fails, then it fails artistically, not because I think I did the wrong thing morally.
How different is it, you know, and what is the type of responsibility that you feel in a different way when you're taking somebody else's work, as you did indeed with our own Cullum Tobin's Brooklyn and adapted that for the screen, or with An Education, which you also adapted for the screen? Talk to me a little bit about the adaptation of Brooklyn. Is it easier to take somebody else's book and, if you like, not tear it apart, but reinvent it for a different medium than it would be to do it with your own?
The problem with doing my own, which I don't do, is I've spent 2 years writing the book, and every movie I've been involved in takes about 5 years to make. So that's 7 years of thinking about the same material, which I really don't want to do. I want to do something fresh. And with Brooklyn and Education and Wild, what I was given was the opportunity to get out of my own head and into somebody else's head, and it feels so refreshing. To have material that I couldn't have generated myself. Cullum's a great writer, but he was so unbelievably supportive that I never really felt that nervous, because he did nothing but encourage us.
Yeah, I suppose being a novelist himself, he possibly understood the dilemma in which you find yourself, you know, the things that you have to face in just moving from one medium to the other.
Yeah, and that things are going to have to get cut, and some things are going to have to be made more explicit. And he was very intuitive about being adapted. And I think that he loved the result. Mm. Well, he turned up to enough screenings, so I think he must have loved the result. He must have seen it like 50 times.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about State of the Union, which I'm guessing this was a COVID-related project, in that it was a 10 minute episodes featuring Chris O'Dowd and Rosamund Pike as a couple with a marriage.
I actually predicted COVID by writing State of the Union. Now, it was entirely kind of whimsical. I was doing a lot of film work at the time, and sometimes you have to wait 3 or 4 weeks for people to read and get back to you, and while they're trying to cast or get money or whatever. And I thought I'd like to not start something long. I'd like to have a go at something short and see where it takes me. And I'd had this idea before and not knowing what to do with it. So I thought I'd just try writing 10-minute episodes and see what happens.
I heard Chris O'Dowd speaking about it, and he talked about, you know, the kind of the density of the dialogue in the 10-minute episode. Were you aware of that, you know, that things were, I suppose, more distilled when it comes to writing a short piece like that?
Well, I mean, you can see it on the page when you're writing it, you know, that each of them had 50% of the script, basically, and they're doing nothing but sitting at a pub table and occasionally crossing the road. Mm. So they're talking all the time, and it was very intense work for the actors. I mean, it was like a 3-week shoot, but I think they had more words in those 100 minutes than they would have had in anything else they'd ever done.
There you go. So what happens next, Nick? Where are you heading? Novels, another short work or adaptation, or do you know what is next on the desk?
I'm working on something that's it's a big TV series. I don't know if it will happen or not, because you never know whether these things will happen. And it's music related, and it's real people.
Oh, well, now I'm tickled. Can you tell me any more? Give me where are the real people from? What city?
Where are the real people from? They're from England, in England.
A city.
Ah.
I think you may have answered it by not answering, perhaps. Okay, well, look, I don't know. We'll see in time. Nick, lovely to speak with you this evening.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a million. That's Nick Hornby speaking to us about his latest novel, Just Like You, which is published by Viking, an imprint of Penguin Books.